You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. My guest today is Carolyn Forché, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet for The Country Between Us, author as well as Gathering the Tribes, and she has edited a really remarkable anthology, which has been the occasion for what will be public chastisement of Michael Silverblatt, your host. This anthology is called Against Forgetting. It's an anthology of 20th century poetry of witness. And I have to begin with a confession, which is a form that many of these poets in the anthology take in the face of horror, the confessional form, which was that my teaching had led me to be suspicious of political poetry. And as I read through this anthology, Against Forgetting, published both in hardcover and paperback by Norton, I became aware that I had suffered from a really unquestioned prejudice, that this really is some of the most extraordinary work of this century, and it is the response to the tone of this century, and it is the place where poetry and life intersect, where poets become not only useful but crucial. And so I'm very happy to have been, you know, exposed to work that I really had not considered in a deep way. Could you, in your introduction, you distinguish between poetry of witness as a more useful term than political poetry per se. Could you explain that?
When I returned from El Salvador, where I'd been working as a human rights activist, I returned in 1980, shortly before the assassination of Monsignor Oscar Romero. And I continued to write my poems after my return to the United States, and I don't think I realized the extent to which I had undergone change within myself and within my work. The poems that emerged on the page were first-person lyric narrative free verse poems, such as I'd always written. But I had inadvertently transgressed against the unspoken or unwritten prohibition against the admission of political or historical or social material into poetry in the United States. So we have a strong tradition of aversion to explicitly political poems. We think of them as not valuable as poetry, and we think of them as often didactic and polemical. And so when I returned from the United States and I wrote these poems and published my second book, The Country Between Us, I was surprised myself to be labeled a political poet. I had not thought of myself as a particularly political person. My understanding of the political, of course, was shaped in Central America, where if one is political, one attends meetings rigorously and is very involved and committed and joins a political party and so on, none of which I'd ever done. I was thinking more in ethical and moral terms and working on behalf of human rights. When the book was published, it fed the fires of the cyclic argument in the United States concerning the relationship between poetry and politics and the poet and the state. And so I had to come to terms with that. I was rather put in the center of it sometimes, and I think my work was both very much praised and very much condemned because of its political content. And it was certainly read almost exclusively in terms of the subject matter of the work. And it was difficult for me to come to terms with that. I didn't really have a view of such things. And I did feel somewhat isolated because I didn't know what to do with myself. I knew I had become other than I had been. And I certainly couldn't force myself to keep things from my work. I began to read. I had always been reading the poetry of poets in translation. As a teenager, American poets began to actively translate contemporary poetry, and I continued that reading, and I found that through that reading, I was discovering poets who had seen wars and had witnessed atrocity and had themselves suffered imprisonment and internment. And I began to read them for camaraderie, for understanding, for solace, and I began to collect their work. Initially, I shared it with my students, and I was always Xeroxing the work. I was building a library of it in my house, and my house was being taken over by it in form of books and Xeroxing, and it was growing up on the walls. And then you remember the copyright laws were changed, altered, and made more restrictive, and teachers like myself were no longer permitted quite the same freedom at the Xerox machine. We were, in fact, turned into criminals sneaking into the Kinko's copy shop late at night to try to copy books for our students without being discovered. But I knew that something had to happen because I couldn't really – this material isn't really widely available. A lot of it's out of print. A lot of it is from other countries. Some of it was published in tiny little manuscripts in the beginning or even passed around in Samizdat underground publications. So,
well, it does have the feeling, as you look through Against Forgetting, of opening up forbidden materials. And one of the things that it immediately struck me, because this anthology goes from the genocide of Armenia up to the present and passes through many nightmares, the world wars, the Shoah, many devastations. And I use the word nightmare intentionally because in a certain sense I became aware as I was reading that much of the poetry is a very radical project here of expressing the inexpressible. And as a result, it is not different from dream poetry. It's that, unfortunately, these dreams and these nightmares have manifested themselves on the surface of the earth, and that people have been responsible for registering, often in shocked language, very close to silence and complete appall, what it is they have seen that they cannot imagine having had to see, having witnessed. And as a result, as you say in the introduction, which must be the result of so much editing, I've never seen so much material covered in such a small space. It seemed to me to be the result of almost inhuman compression. But you point out that this poetry takes in responses to the holy or the absence of it, to the nature of media broadcasts, ironic poems which imitate newscasts, surrealist travelogues, imaginary battlefields and postcards from them, that all of the kinds of poetry that we've come to associate with this century are expressive of the events of terror that you've gathered the witnesses to. I would imagine, then, that there is a certain amount of recoil. The first thing that struck me was that perhaps American academicians have a hostility to political poetry because, having lived in America and having repressed or denied our involvements for so long, our poets are not by any means the best political poets. When you look at Russian political poetry, when you look at South American political poetry, you realize that these are muscles that have had to be developed. But the American poetry of the Vietnam War is to some extent crude. The poets were being called upon to do something that they didn't know how to do.
I think that's very true. In coming to terms with this idea of the political, people who defended political poetry would say, but all poetry is political. And of course, any poem can be read for the presence and absence of political content. But I didn't find that particularly useful. I wanted something that would be useful in understanding. And I began to wonder why we separated the personal and the political so profoundly. And I thought in terms of a realm between them. a realm of the social, the realm of debate, the realm in which poems are written and published, and the society argues with it, with itself, about itself. And it draws those arguments from personal life, and it, and those arguments are what is supposed to inform the state. And I thought this is where poetry takes place. It's a poetry, the work that I gathered together, I began to feel, well, for one thing, there's a number of issues that I could bring up here. One of them is that I began to see that the anthology, as I had put it together, tells the story of the century according to the poets who most suffered its conditions. And I began to listen in these poems for a special speech of the human soul, and to hear it, and to realize that each of these poets were contributing a voice to a kind of symphony of utterance, that, and that each of these poets were marked by the conditions they endured. They were marked and wounded by their experiences. So were their souls, and so was their language. And so the language itself emerges marked by extremity, bearing the trace of that extremity within it. And I realized that this had nothing to do with subject matter, that you could, yes, you could include a poem that was explicitly about the war. You could also include a poem by a poet who experienced war or imprisonment or internment and was writing about the snow falling, and you could see the war in the snow falling. And that these poems pass through the reader in a very unusual way. They seem to bring that moment to remembrance again. Remembrance, not the kind of remembrance that finishes something off, that says, well, now we've put up our monument and we're done with that, and now we can put it behind us and forget. There's a kind of remembrance like that, a memorializing remembrance that contributes to forgetfulness. And I felt that poetry had a power to work against that kind of forgetfulness. So I wanted a living language memorial to the 20th century, and that's what I began to feel that this was. I found that I gathered about 3,000 pages initially, and I discovered, well, to my horror and sadness, that most of the poets of the 20th century writing outside the borders of the United States qualified for inclusion. They were either in wars or lived under military dictatorship or were forced into exile or were imprisoned, tortured under interrogation, placed under house arrest. I began to just read the poets, and I would then find in the biography the reason why they could be studied in light of this idea of witness. Within the United States, one tended to see this experience in this narrow sense exclusively among poets of color and poets, well, perhaps of working class poets who were conscripted to serve in foreign wars. So I also began to think about this issue of representation that emerges in critical theory debates over the last few decades, and I realized that this work is, none of it is attempting to represent events like Auschwitz. But each of these works is a little piece of Auschwitz or a little piece of the Armenian genocide, because it is the language that is left on the boneyard ground from the poet's voice who went through it, and is as much, therefore, evidence of what occurred as the piles of eyeglasses and the piles of toothbrushes and razor blades collected in the camps are evidence.
I was particularly drawn to the notion that you bring up in relation to the poetry of Paul Celan, that as a result of what this poetry witnesses, its language can never be the same. Its language endures a kind of deformation or torture that must ever after reflect the events it describes. I would like to ask you to read a representative poem, but I'll let you choose where to start.
I'd like to say more about Celan when we come to Celan, but the book begins with a motto from Bertolt Brecht, and that motto is, "In the dark times, will there also be singing?" Yes, there will be singing about the dark times. This is a poem by Anna Akhmatova. She was a Russian poet. She was born in 1889 and died in 1966. She outlived her three husbands and her son, who died in prison. Anna Akhmatova was officially banned in the Soviet Union between 1925 and 1940, and then again for a decade after World War II. She was she would wait outside of the prison in Leningrad when her son was interned there, and she was would hold baskets of provisions, hoping to get them past the guards and to her son. And this is a little poem. She wrote a long poem called Requiem about that internment and her experience of it. And I'd like to begin with just a little passage at the beginning and then read a section of it, which is called Instead of a Preface. Requiem. No foreign sky protected me. No stranger's wing shielded my face. I stand as witness to the common lot, survivor of that time, that place. Instead of a preface. In the terrible years of the Yeshov terror, I spent 17 months waiting in line outside the prison in Leningrad. One day somebody in the crowd identified me. Standing behind me was a woman with lips blue from the cold, who had, of course, never heard me called by name before. Now she started out of the torpor common to us all and asked me in a whisper. Everyone whispered there. Can you describe this? And I said, I can. Then something like a smile passed fleetingly over what had once been her face. Mm-hmm. There's one of her compatriots, Osip Mandelstam. Osip Mandelstam's wife, Nadezhda, preserved his poetry by memorizing it. And this is Osip Mandelstam's poem, I Was Washing Outside in the Darkness. I was washing outside in the darkness, the sky burning with rough stars, and the starlight, salt on an axe blade. The cold overflows the barrel, the gates locked, the lands grim as its conscience. I don't think they'll find the new weaving finer than truth anywhere. Star salt is melting in the barrel, icy water is turning blacker, death's growing purer, misfortune saltier, the earth's moving nearer to truth and to dread.
I wondered if you would, in illustration of the way in which a poem can be about snow but reflect Auschwitz, I wondered if you would read the poem you write about, Spring.
Radnoti?
Yes, I think so. Let me.
I wrote about so many.
No, Hikmet.
Hikmet.
Yeah.
Yes, I'd be happy to read Hikmet. Hikmet was someone who was very early. Very early in this work, I collected Hikmet, who is beautifully translated by Randy Blazing and his wife Mutlu Konak. Hikmet spent over half of his adult life in prison, and was. It's such a shocking history, really. He began writing poems while he was in the Naval Academy, and then he was expelled for taking part in a strike. He taught in Turkey, became a socialist, and published his first book of poetry in 1922. He enrolled at the University of the Workers of the East in Moscow and returned to Turkey in 1924. The years 1925 and 1933 were marked by exile in the Soviet Union and imprisonment in Turkey. Finally, he was arrested in 1938 for allegedly fomenting revolt among naval cadets. His trial was a legal scandal and resulted in a 35-year sentence. He wrote these poems in prison and was released in 1951, thanks in part to the efforts of Jean-Paul Sartre, Pablo Neruda, and Pablo Picasso. For the remainder of his life, he lived in Eastern Europe. So the poem Spring, it's beautiful, and it is a prison poem. It's a letter to his wife, actually. Letters from a Man in Solitary, I believe, is the one you're referring to.
Mm-hmm.
I carved your name on my watch band with my fingernail. Where I am, you know, I don't have a pearl-handled jackknife. They won't give me anything sharp, or a plane tree with its head in the clouds. Trees may grow in the yard, but I'm not allowed to see the sky overhead. How many others are in this place? I don't know. I'm alone far from them, They are altogether far from me. To talk to anyone besides myself is forbidden, so I talk to myself. But I find my conversation so boring, my dear wife, that I sing songs. And what do you know? That awful, always off-key voice of mine touches me so that my heart breaks. And just like the barefoot orphan lost in the snow, in those old sad stories, my heart, with moist blue eyes and a little red runny nose, wants to snuggle up in your arms. It doesn't make me blush that right now I'm this weak, this selfish, this human, simply. No doubt my state can be explained, physiologically, psychologically, etc., or maybe it's this barred window, this earthen jug, these four walls, which for months have kept me from hearing another human voice. It's 5 o'clock, my dear. Outside, with its dryness, eerie whispers, mud roof, and lame, skinny horse standing motionless in infinity, I mean it's enough to drive the man inside crazy with grief. Outside, with all its machinery and all its art, a plains night comes down red on treeless space. Again today, night will fall in no time, and light will circle the lame, skinny horse. And the treeless space in this hopeless landscape stretched out before me like the body of a hard man will suddenly be filled with stars. We'll reach the inevitable end once more, which is to say the stage is set again today for an elaborate nostalgia. Me, the man inside, once more I'll exhibit my customary talent, and singing an old-fashioned lament in the reedy voice of my childhood, once more, by God, it will crush my unhappy heart to hear you inside my head, so far away, as if I were watching you in a smoky, broken mirror. It's spring outside, my dear wife. Spring. Outside on the plain, suddenly the smell of fresh earth, birds singing. It's spring, my dear wife. The plain outside sparkles, and inside the bed comes alive with bugs. The water jug no longer freezes, and in the morning sun floods the concrete. The sun. Every day till noon now it comes and goes for me, flashing off and on. And as the day turns to afternoon, shadows climb the walls. The glass of the barred window catches fire, and it's night outside, a cloudless spring night. And inside, this is spring's darkest hour. In short, the demon called freedom, with its glittering scales and fiery eyes, possesses the man inside, especially in the spring. I know this from experience, my dear wife, from experience.
This is Carolyn Fourche reading Nassim Hikmet's Letters from a Man in Solitary, a poem included in the anthology Against Forgetting, which she has edited. It's an anthology of 20th century poetry of witness, recently published by Norton. Now, one of the things that you mentioned in the introduction is that whereas outside spring has flowers and customary images, inside spring liberates the bed bugs. You know, spring unthaws the water in the prisoner's pail, letting us know implicitly how cold it's been in the prison cell. So much becomes significant again in this kind of poetry that we have taken for granted, so that weirdly, while the event, as you mentioned in the introduction, is a trauma, the poetry is a redress to trauma.
The poet attempts that there. As I began to assemble this work, I began to hear the voices calling back and forth to each other within the volume. And sometimes they would even address each other directly, naming each other as poets. But there, the poems seem to call to each other across time, across languages, across events, through extremity. And this transformation of imagery was very interesting in much of the poetry, just as spring is might be thought of in romantic terms, in the romantic tradition, as as a time that is inexorably bound to the poet's feelings of renewal and birth and rebirth, rather. And in the prison context, it's utterly transformed. We also see that with, for example, the images of sunrise and sunset, which prior to the First World War were inexorably bound to images of contemplation and a contemplation of time and painterly beauty and so on. And with the First World War, sunrise and sunset marks the beginning and ends of battles and the beginning and end of horror. And so sunrise and sunset become utterly different. The moon itself, which was regarded as the poet's light, the poet's, became something sinister, which could expose people hiding in a forest or give people away who were trying to escape or trying to run in the under cover of nightfall. So many of the images that we associate as poetic emerge very differently in this work of Witness.
Well, you know, it's not as if these poets are the neglected poets. I was happy to find some of my beloved poems of Apollinaire here. And, you know, poems that one has always known and cared about. What was moving to me about this anthology, which, I don't know, you must pardon me for calling noble. One of the things that I guess I looked immediately, because in my uninformed ways, I said, oh, Carolyn Forché has done an anthology of political poetry, of course. And I looked to see, is Carolyn Forché in the anthology, expecting immediately to be contemptuous? And it's a noble anthology. You didn't include your own work. It's, you know, it's an act of, I think, generosity. And I found that the politics of anthologies often are about, you were telling me earlier that some people have asked you who is not here, who hasn't been here. But it seemed to me that this anthology is not the anthology that you put out and then poets say, where's my work? Where's my work? This is a human project, a humanitarian project. And what it is not a testament to a series of identities, but a testament to a universality of experience that sweeps identity aside. And the meditations throughout on anonymity, on being reduced to the state just before nothing, the language that emerges from that like a stench, covers the world. You know, it's sort of an amazing project.
Thank you very much. I couldn't include myself. I just couldn't. But I am happy to say that I really am not trying to produce a canonical work of Witness. And I know that anthologies are often read as, you know, the selected consecrated works. And in this case, 3,000 some pages were collected and assembled and easily could have been included. And so for various reasons, I had to make a very deep selection in the work, and I was able to include less than a third of what I had in a volume that would still be affordable.
That collection is Against Forgetting, an anthology of the 20th century poetry of Witness, edited and introduced by my guest today, Carolyn Forché. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse club time.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.